Yeah, so delighted to be here. Leo, I think, wanted me to be here to try and give a report of the condition of the correlated electron problem, at least in the cuprates, for the program having to do with cold atoms, since more and more attention in the cold atom field is turning to the correlated n-body problem. So I tried my best to break it down and into as much of a detailed introduction as you can bear to the cuprate problem. maybe not. and then I want to talk primarily about the superconductivity, the D-wave superconductivity today, the familiar parts of it and the parts which are really unfamiliar and still remain to be understood. And then tomorrow I'm going to talk about issues which are the bugaboo of theorists, things they really don't want to know about. But unfortunately, the cuprates are real crystals with real crystalline degrees of freedom, dopant atoms, crystal distortions.
Why unfortunate?
Well, it's I'm on the record here, so I should be careful. But everyone desires to reduce the complexity of this problem to the level where you have a simple one-line Hamiltonian, and then you solve that Hamiltonian, you have a glorious solution. 21 years after the discovery of high TC, perhaps there's a reason to deduce that maybe that scheme doesn't work, and you have to focus on the reality of the materials rather than the glorious one-line Hamiltonian. So tomorrow I'm going to talk a lot about the dirty reality of interaction between the fermions and the crystal in which they live. And then on Wednesday, I'm going to talk, I hope, about the first imaging of the mysterious pseudo-gap state of the cuprate electronic structure.
50 years to get PCS?
Yeah, well, 21. It took even longer than that for superfluid helium-4 to be understood, so. I'm here representing a collaboration of Professor Uchida at the University of Tokyo and Dr. Isaki at SCUBA, my former student and colleague Kyle McElroy, who's now at Boulder, and present members of my group in Cornell. And I want to talk about how you visualize complex, here electronic matter. Perhaps Marcus is going to tell us how to do this for cold atoms. That would be fabulous. I have to tell you about this CuO6 octahedron and its physics. Then I'll tell a little bit about hole doping the CuO2 plane of the cuprates. Then I'll tell you the technique that we have developed to access the electronic matter directly. And then I'll tell you a little bit about elementary properties of the superconductivity, some really surprising properties having to do with nanoscale electronic disorder, and I hope I'll explain the source of those phenomena tomorrow. And then I'm going to tell you about imaging interference of the coherent, well-defined quasiparticles and how we can use it to measure momentum space electronic structure using real space data. And then finally, I'll tell you about data which is just coming out now, telling us how the excitation spectrum evolves as we go from the D-wave superconductor towards the insulator. Please stop me and ask questions. Okay, CuO6. So here's lanthanum cuprate, barium doped, the first high TC superconductor. And the elementary object of most relevance in here is this octahedron of six oxygen atoms surrounding one copper atom. The copper's in the 3d9 state. It has lost two electrons. The oxygens are in the 2p6 state. They have gathered two electrons each and closed their p-shell. You will find papers and textbooks, etc., telling you that once the p-shell is closed, these objects are inert. They play no role in the physics. So one can abstract this into a site-centered square lattice of spin halves. That is completely wrong, I assure you. The oxygens are critical for the performance of the electronic structure. So here's what happens to the d states. Here are the atomic d states, five of them. They're split by the crystal fields with octahedral symmetry into these two manifolds, the EG and the T2G manifold, familiar to chemists. And in the cuprates, the symmetry of the octahedron is broken. This apical oxygen atom moves away, and it further splits the five orbitals into this basis set. And here they're lined up in terms of energy. So the highest energy set is basis state is dx squared minus y squared. And we're in a 3d9 state, and there would be 10 electrons there. So these eight are filled, and there's a single electron in this orbital. That's an ionic insulator. Here are the orbitals we're dealing with. This is the one which is usually regarded as being critical to the cuprate superconductivity. There certainly is a community of solid-state physicists who also regard this orbital to be critical to the D-wave superconductivity. We may have to discuss that tomorrow. So if we just ignore this lower manifold of the T2G states and consider these two higher energy states, the in-plane electronic structure is then governed by hybridization by the p orbitals of the oxygen atoms and the dx squared minus y squared orbital. And the out-of-plane, and indeed some of the in-plane physics, is governed by hybridization of the pz orbital with this d orbital. So today I'm going to talk mostly about physics of this situation. And on Thursday, physics again. And there I'll be focusing on oxygen. And tomorrow I'm going to talk about phenomena which are largely governed, at least in my opinion, by the out-of-plane orbitals.
Then these phenomena will be well separated, really?
Nope, definitely not. Nope. In a perovskite, you know, the energy level, okay, good question. So these two energy levels may be separated by several volts. Let's say 5 volts for the sake of argument. But it'll turn out, for example, that the separation of the oxygen P level from the relevant copper D level is also separated by 2 to 3 volts. So the idea that this one is irrelevant is completely untrue. The admixture of these states is delicately controlled by the geometrical location of that atom. Ole Anderson has done very nice work on that. Now, so here's the cartoon-like representation we are often presented with for the CuO2 plane of the cuprates. It's a square lattice. The oxygens are 2p6. The coppers are 3d9, and they have one electron each. If you were to write down a traditional solid-state physics band structure, it would be you would end up with a three-band model, a D and 2P states, and it would be an antibonding band. And it should be a conductor, obviously, since there's one electron in each orbital. Now, the reality is different. The D band is split by Coulomb interactions on the copper site. So it splits. Here's the lower D band, which is filled, and the upper D band, which is empty. And the on-site Coulomb interaction, I'm going to call it E, because I want to keep it separate from U, the Hubbard U, appearing later in the discussions. This system is a class of Mott insulator. It's not a simple Mott insulator. It's called a charge transfer insulator. And the reason is that the available charge fluctuations are not between the filled and the empty D state, but they're between a P state and the empty D state. This energy here is about 3 volts. It's called a charge transfer energy. Now, one is usually presented with some type of Hubbard model to represent this electronic structure. That model involves a Hopping rate, of course, fermionic operators, and the on-site Hubbard energy U. And you can parameterize in some models of the cuprate. This number is about 3 volts, and this number is about 400 millivolts. It's a very high Hopping rate. And in that case, if you allow U to go to infinity, you can write down a TJ model, where this is the effective exchange energy, 4T squared over U. And under those circumstances, you see immediately that it is an antiferromagnetic insulator, because there's virtual hopping between these sites. when the spins are ordered antiferromagnetically. And the cuprates are all antiferromagnetic insulators before they're hole doped. Now the problem with these two pictures is, of course, they're not actually consistent with this electronic structure. We have to talk in a little bit more detail about how it could be legitimate to use a Hubbard model or a TJ model. And the usual argument that's put forward is the following. If we consider this electronic structure in terms of holes, in terms of hole hopping, there is a transport process, but it's the charge fluctuation process between the d orbital and the p orbital. So a hole could hop from d to p and then from p to d. So the rate there would be tpd squared, and that takes the place of the hopping rate in your Hubbard model. So under those circumstances, then it would be tpd, the usual Hubbard model is t squared over u, but now the effective t is tpd squared, so this is tpd to the fourth divided by this energy splitting, the charge transfer energy cubed. That's what gives you an effective exchange interaction between the spins and the copper sites. And if you stop here, it's still a very friendly and attractive picture of a one-band Hubbard model to describe a rather complicated problem. However, to turn the material from, and this would be the correct presentation because it is an antiferromagnetic charge transfer insulator, but to turn it into a high TC superconductor, you have to hole dope it. If you go to hole dope your Hubbard model, you're going to be dealing with these sites. But now let's see what happens if you hold up the cuprates. So here is your charge transfer electronic structure. Hole doping involves removing the highest energy electron, which is here in the P band. So that's where the hole goes. If you don't believe me, you can look at resonant X-ray studies, which show very clearly, there's a very beautiful run recently by Abamonte and colleagues, which show very clearly that the holes go on the oxygen sites. That's the energetically favorable site. So they don't go on the copper sites. And in fact, when the hole arrives on the oxygen site, the quantum mechanical structure here is, there are several different possibilities. You could imagine it being hole localized here, or in the famous Zhang-Rice singlet, it's delocalized on four oxygen atoms. Somehow, this object has to create the single band electronic structure that you subsequently want to use some type of Hubbard or TJ model to describe. But the physics of how this happens really hasn't been studied in the level of detail that it deserves. So I will come back to this issue in my talk on Thursday. But I want you to keep in mind that the holes are certainly not on the copper site, which you were going to represent by your one band Hubbard model. Now, if you hold up the cuprates, your antiferromagnetic charge transfer insulator disappears once you have a few percent of holes. It's a 2D antiferromagnet. And then some very mysterious unknown phase appears. Today I'm going to call it electronic cluster glass phase. And eventually, when you get to high enough hole density, the high TC D-wave superconductivity appears. And finally, when you get to an even higher hole density, above 25% holes, one hole per four sites, then a metal appears and the superconductivity is gone. Obviously, the challenge is to understand, and even better, to predict this phase diagram. So in the elementary electronic structure description, we face a number of challenges. One is that it's a three-band system. Another one is that there definitely are powerful on-site correlations. Another is that there's a huge exchange energy, one of the largest in any known material, 150 millivolts. And finally, the holes are not doped to the copper sites, they're doped to the oxygen sites. Okay, so the D-wave superconductivity is underneath this famous dome here, and the maximum is somewhere near 16% of hole density. And so I want to tell you just a few things about it. It's a relatively benign phase of electronic matter. There are about 25 families of cuprates now, and they're all ionic charge transfer insulators. When they're undoped and when they're chemically doped, they all become high TC superconductors, and the maximum TC is always on the hole doped side. And they all have a single structural common element. It's the CuO2 plane. The stuff outside the CuO2 plane can be very, very different in different materials. This is the key reason to believe that there is a single simple theory which should describe these materials, because the only common element here is the CuO2 plane, and they're all high TC superconductors. Near optimal doping, they're a very nice tight binding band structure is detected by photoemission. You can find the location of the Fermi energy, and you can even map the contours of the excitations with modern photoemission technology.
This is for this calculation for what cube, right?
So this isn't a calculation. This is a parameterization from the data from photoemission for EFK in BISCO. Now, in the superconducting phase, the gap opens on this Fermi surface, but it's a D-wave gap, so that it has a maximum here at the zone face, and it has a minimum at the node, and another maximum over here, like this. So this is very widely accepted now that this very beautiful D-wave gap opens on the Fermi surface in the superconducting state. We know it's D-wave from phase-sensitive experiments. Once that gap opens, it reorganizes the electronic structure in a very interesting way. Originally, you had a nice hole pocket Fermi surface here, but now you open this D-wave gap. The gap magnitude here is zero, but the gap magnitude here is very large. For any cut, there is two Bogoliubov excitation branches, but the gap is different on different locations, and that reorganizes the electronic structure into these closed banana-like contours of excitation for Bogoliubov quasiparticles. Okay, now here's a real problem for glorious theories of the cuprates. Just focus here. This is monolayer cuprates. These are systems where there's a single layer of CuO2 in the unit cell, and at the same doping, the critical temperature can vary very widely in these materials. Between 2 to 1, it's around 7 Kelvin, and mercury-based material, actually, it's around 115 Kelvin now. So they have the same electronic structure, and they have the same number of holes in the CuO2 plane. So if you believe that there is a single theory that can describe the cuprates, it needs at least one more parameter than the hole density and T and J in the CuO2 plane, because TC can vary widely even though the materials are supposedly identical in the CuO2 plane. Now, the materials colleagues have very good ideas why this happened. It has to do with the atoms which are outside the CuO2 plane and what they do to the electronic structure. Okay, so now the pseudo-gap regime. Down here at low doping, there is a mysterious electronic regime which now has been studied since around 1989, so for a very long time. It's almost coming up to its 20th anniversary. And a great deal is known about it except the explanation for why it exists. So one thing we know is that down here at low doping, imagine coming down in temperature and just measure the uniform susceptibility of the spins in the CuO2 plane. As you come down here, the spins are independent of susceptibility, independent of temperature, like they should be in a metal. But when you cross this pseudo-gap line, the susceptibility dives down. This is true in all cuprates. So something is freezing out all the spin degrees of freedom. Maybe they form singlets. Maybe they form little droplets of antiferromagnetism. Maybe they form something else. But something is removing their spin susceptibility at temperatures which are enormously higher. Let's say room temperature, the spins are already losing their susceptibility, even though at that doping, TC might be 25 Kelvin, 10 times lower. Another thing we know is from the heat capacity of the electrons in the electron gas. When you come down on this line again, here, this is the linear coefficient of heat capacity. C is gamma times T. So it should be a flat line. And up here, it is a flat line, as it should be. But when you cross this line, then the linear coefficient begins to dive down. And the farther down you go in doping, the higher the temperature at which you cross that line, and the more loss there is of entropy, basically. Electronic degrees of freedom are being frozen out of this system. Thermodynamically, they can no longer contribute to the excited states. And then, so when you cross this line, you see the freezing out. And when you cross this line, you see the peak in the heat capacity, which comes from the formation of the D-wave BCS state.
Gamma is the coefficient.
Linear coefficient, yeah. C is gamma times T. This is a huge effect, really an amazing effect. Almost all the electronic degrees of freedom are frozen near room temperature, and a few remaining states manage to condense into the D-wave BCS state down here at low doping. There is a gap in the density of states up here in momentum space, the same part of momentum space where in the superconductor there's a big gap because it's a D-wave superconductor. In the non-superconducting phase, there's a big gap at the zone phase, and it starts at really high temperatures at low doping. In addition to that, in momentum space, there's a gap near the zone phase, but near the node, the electronic excitations survive and retain their quantum mechanical coherence near the node. But elsewhere, they appear to be so-called incoherent. That just means there's no peak in the photoemission spectrum telling you that there's a well-defined state in momentum space.
Is this in normal state or in superconducting?
This is in the normal state effectively because TC is very low in these materials. And so here's the other part of the picture. Near optimal doping, you do have a peak in AK of omega at the zone phase, but as you go down in doping, it disappears. When you get down here someplace, the peak which told you there was an antinodal quasiparticle has disappeared. So there have been many summaries of this gap magnitude here. It's perfectly obvious that there's a large gap in the density of states, and it affects both the spin and the charge. You can detect it with all kinds of different techniques, and it grows approximately linearly with falling doping. Here's a detection with Raman, the Raman signature near the zone face, or with the symmetry so that you detect near the zone face, is completely different than near the node. The last thing which is really interesting about this mysterious phase is that effectively it's some kind of a strange insulator, because if you kill the superconductivity with a high magnetic field, you're left in the background state. And the background state, its resistivity rises logarithmically with falling temperature. So it does always conduct charge, but it's a very poor charge conductor, and it gets worse and worse and worse. Okay. So now we have even more challenges. We have these basic challenges to describe the electronic structure in the unit cell. And now we have this pseudo-gap regime where the susceptibility and the heat capacity and the transport and all the thermodynamic degrees of freedom are being frozen out. This pseudo-gap scale is linearly decreasing with growing hole density, and it has a gap in the single particle density of states, which is D-wave-like. And it's a weakly insulating regime in the background. Okay, now we turn to some considerations of theory. Now, one class of theory proposed right from the beginning is the so-called RVB theory. This is a theory where there is a soup of singlets in the environment. Once you put the holes in, there are singlets, there are holes, and they're just moving all around together in some strange fashion. And over the years, these theories have been analyzed in terms of slave boson mean field, gauge fluctuations, so-called renormalized mean field schemes. Here's a projective scheme for using a trial wave function. And now with modern techniques, people are actually solving the full for the full state in detail. At the end of the day, what you're trying to do is to figure out how much energy it costs to have the holes in here, how much energy per hole, how much energy you save per singlet, what's the balance between those two things. Starting from Anderson's Gutzwiller projection scheme and working forward, essentially people are trying to figure out, is this the lowest free energy state to have these singlets moving around in this environment? Now, this state has the very nice property that basically in any one of these techniques, you'll find that there's a gap in the density of, that there's a spectroscopic gap which rises linearly with falling doping. That was there right from the beginning. You could see it in Gabi's paper. He just put it on two different graphs so that this line was on one graph and this line was on another graph. People really didn't notice it, but it is there. So Anderson has argued very strongly now that this is one of the key features related to this being the basic state of the cuprates. The difficulty with that argument is that one can find other electronic states which could also have this large d-symmetry gap. Well, this one is actually competing antiferromagnetism. It's not clear exactly what its gap would look like. But there are these orbital phases where you consider the degrees of freedom of the system, including the orbital currents in each plaquette. And some of those, especially staggered flux phase and the d-density wave phase, would have a d-symmetry gap in the normal state. Then there's another class of states which originally it wasn't really felt that they would have a gap, but at least they're competing states which would be suppressing the superconductivity, and those are spin and charge ordered states like stripes. And finally, there's a third class of theory, which is somehow, mixture is the wrong word, but there's some connection between these two types of theories. And the third class of theory involves breaking, let's say, translational symmetry or rotational symmetry by making some real space patterns in the electronic structure, but using dimer-like excitations or using whole pairs to make those patterns. So these are crystal, the simplest way to think about them are crystals of singlets or crystals of whole pairs forming a real space structure which would indeed suppress the superconductivity, and precisely why they would have this linear gap I think remains to be determined. There's a whole pair crystal proposal from...
Does it require the doubling of elementary cell?
Pardon?
This third kind of theory,
yeah.
Does it require the doubling of elementary cell?
It some do, some don't. One of the key things it requires is the loss of C4 symmetry of the antiferromagnet. Almost all of these schemes lose the C4 symmetry immediately and leave you in a system with C2 symmetry. Why this guy would be a marginal insulator, I don't know. Why some of these guys would be insulators is perfectly obvious. They're charge-ordered states. And how these guys would be insulators is a very delicate balance that Marcel could explain to us. But it is a possibility that these frozen spins and whole pairs could indeed produce an insulating state. Okay, so now among our challenges, we have the basic electronic structure. I didn't emphasize it before, but the screening of the Coulomb interactions is almost non-existent at low doping in the cube rates. The dielectric constant is like 12, so there are in fact huge Coulomb interactions. It's difficult for me, let me to say parenthetically, how any cold atom would ever be able to simulate this situation. I don't see it. But this is a key piece of the cube rate electronic structure. TC is a strong function of the out-of-plane variables. And now how come after all of these fabulous proposals and tons of experiments over 20 years, we don't know what this phase is? Well, there's one key reason. It's because each one of these order parameters would have some long-range symmetry breakings. They would break rotational symmetry, they would break translational symmetry. Associated with the phase transition, there would be some symmetry change. And there would be a real thermodynamic signature associated with that change. And if I understand it, and Marcel can correctly, that would also be true for these states if they had long-range order. However, no long-range order has ever been observed in 20 years of searching in this part of the phase diagram. That's actually the stumbling block which is behind the scenes here, why progress isn't made. Okay. So we wanted to look at these problems by looking at the electronic structure directly in real space. And we do that by using STM. With a conventional STM, you have one atom. It's scanning back and forth over a surface. You keep the tunnel current constant. You can construct some very nice picture telling you where the atoms are on the top layer. This is a strontium atom. This is a bismuth atom. And this is a chlorine atom. So if you want to do spectroscopic STM, knowing where the atoms are doesn't help you very much. What you want to know is where the wave functions are. So to do that, you can measure the differential tunnel conductance. So if you look at this diagram here, suppose the tip is a piece of metal The density of states as a function of energy is flat near the Fermi energy in the tip, and it's filled to the Fermi energy. And here's your unknown material, but it's metallic, so it has some strange density of states, and it's filled to its Fermi energy. When this bias voltage is zero, no current flows. But when you apply a potential difference, you unbalance the two Fermi energies, and these states here are free to tunnel into these empty states, so that the tunnel current is the integral of the density of states in the sample up to an energy controlled by the battery. Well, that's very nice. There are two other unknown factors here which will play a big role in my discussion on Thursday. This means that if you modulate the bias voltage, DI, you're going to get a modulated current, which is the local density of states times dV. So DI dV, the differential conductance, as a function of V, the bias voltage, is functionally the same as the density of states as a function of energy. So here's what you do. You take a picture of the surface. You can zoom in and see each atom. Put your STM tip at one atom. Measure differential conductance as a function of bias. You get some function like this. But now what you want to do is to make a complete spectroscopic map. So you're going to do it at every location. So you go to the first atom, you measure this. The second atom, measure this. And so on and so on and so on and so on until you have mapped the electronic structure. I can show you the result of such a map. I have to use a color scale here. So I'm going to use this color scale. High density of states will be green and red. Medium will be blue. Low density of states will be black.
Initial formula, I also had a pre-integral factor. What are you doing with it?
We have been ignoring it for about 5 years, but that was a mistake. In the material I'll show you today doesn't suffer from severe systematic errors due to that prefactor. But as we go closer and closer to the insulator, those systematic errors become larger and larger, and we've had to find new techniques to deal with them. Okay, so if I measure the differential conductance at a given energy, let's say minus 100 millivolts, it's this greenish intensity, and I measure it at every location. And then, in principle, one can do that for every energy. So here's the evolution with energy, here's the density of electronic states. It's atomically resolved. As we go down in energy, it's relatively homogeneous. When we reach this point, it'll become heterogeneous at the 3 nanometer scale. And then when we go down inside, this is the D wave gap. I'll come back to that. It becomes homogeneous again. And then we head down to the Fermi energy. And when we get to the Fermi energy, we'll see a small number of impurity scattering resonances. These are the things I'm going to talk about today.
These numbers which appear here, what is that? It is
quasi-particle energy.
It's length, yeah? It's a distance to
the Fermi energy. Okay.
Sorry.
Let's do this again.
Let's say again.
Okay. At every location, you're going to measure the differential conductance as a function of bias voltage. And you call that the density of electronic states as a function of energy. So at any given energy, I know the value of the differential conductance, and I know it at every location. So this is the value of the differential conductance at this energy at every location. Then when
energy
I...
Energy is just V.
Pardon? Energy is just EV, right?
EV.
And now when I run this movie, I'm just changing the energy of the tunneling electrons and measuring the associated change in the differential conductance.
So this is motion along this curve?
No, this is a movie of the density of electronic state. Yeah, it's motion along this axis is this variable, right? So you can end up with an atomically resolved image of the density of electronic states. I'm going to run short of time, so I'm not going to tell you anything about technology. Anybody who wants to know how this machine works, I would be delighted to tell you at another time. Let me just show you that unlike a conventional STM, where you get a nice picture of where the atoms are at the surface, our objective is to see where the electronic wave functions are. And indeed, we have developed schemes now to do that very efficiently. In about 12 hours, we can get a complete electronic map of a new material. You give me a new crystal whose electronic structure is unknown. If we can access the surface, we put it in the machine. 12 hours later, we would know the electronic structure with atomic resolution. This was widely known to be impossible. Okay. So here's the cuprate high TC superconductor that we study. One of the things we have to do in our present technology is break the crystal. We break the crystal at an ionically neutral layer. This is the bismuth oxide layer. And that layer is two layers above the CuO2 plane. People sometimes ask me, are we not plagued by the difficulties of surface science, where the termination of the bands gives you very different phenomena at the surface of a piece of material? And the answer is definitely no. This is not surface science. There are two high gap insulating layers between the vacuum, where the tip is, and where we measure the electronic structure. High gap oxide insulators are the basis of your computer. They work very well. You can tunnel electrons through them very easily, and they're transparent. But they protect the CuO2 layer from being perturbed by the vacuum. Essentially, this is a bulk measurement in a material which is two-dimensional. If you take a surface picture, you could see where each atom is. We need that information to tell us where various orbitals are in the CuO2 plane. Okay, so here's another one of these movies now. Let me see what this one looks like. Density of states as a function of location and energy. Again, we go down here in energy. When we come near this energy here, we see some really horrible disorder. And then when we go down in here.
Why is it so irregular?
Pardon?
Why is it so irregular?
Good question. I will show you in a few minutes. There are actually, I want to make a comment here. Recently, because of some of the very strange things which are being observed by everyone doing these experiments, proposals have begun to appear that this spectrum doesn't actually represent the spectrum of the D-wave superconductor. So I would like to shoot down that argument. So first of all, D-wave BCS would have a spectrum on a circular Fermi surface that looks like this. And this is not inconsistent with it. Here's the gap maximum at the zone face, and here's the node here with a little bit of density of states due to scattering. In addition to that, you can ask, what happens to this spectrum if I actually kill the superconductivity in a vortex core? So here's what happens when this is a map of vortex core locations. When you're far away from the core, it looks like this. When you approach within 25 angstroms, it looks like this. And when you get to the vortex center, it looks like this. There is external magnetic field here, I think about 6 or 7 Tesla to produce the vortices. But my point is that with the destruction of the D-wave order parameter in the vortex core, these objects diminish and disappear just as they should. You can see this in detail. Here you're approaching the core. Here you're coming within coherence length. The coherence peaks go down. And then you come back out on the other side and they come up again. The reason why they do that is that this is the spectrum of D-wave BCS superconductor. You could double check this argument. You could put a unitary scatterer, which would also destroy the superconductivity locally, and see what happens. It makes an in-gap state, but there's a conservation of spectral weight in D-wave BCS, so it suppresses the coherence peaks. So we can find where these objects are by looking for the in-gap state. And so here's a picture, for example, of a real space image of the impurity state at each zinc atom. And now we can ask, what happens to the coherence peaks as we approach this zinc atom from infinity? And what happens is they get suppressed way down as the impurity state appears, just as it should be. This is further evidence that this is the D-wave BCS spectrum and not something else. So that's my opinion. Okay. Now, there are three energy scales that you've seen here in these movies. There's a low energy scale. There's this horrible disordered high energy scale. And there's the scale out here. I'm going to talk about this tomorrow. It's outside the gap. So the lowest energy scale is where the nodal quasiparticles are. If you focus on this low energy scale and look at this density of states movie, you see that it does have very nice patterns in it. And those patterns change their wavelength, their wave vectors, with energy in some way which is difficult to understand by just looking in real space. But they do so in a particle hole symmetric sense. You'll see them changing their wave vectors. Going to rotate now by 45 degrees. and changing their wavelengths. So what's going on here? If we look in detail, let's take each density of states image and its Fourier transform. At some high energy, you see that there is a little bit of structure here. Here are the atomic locations in this crystal, but there's a lot of disorder. If we go down in energy, though, very soon, the Fourier transform of the real space density of states shows a very beautiful structure in Q-space. Making this pattern, there are only 16 Q-vectors.
This is Fourier transform of that?
Yes. So in this strange pattern here, there are only 16 independent Q-vectors. And they have a very nice symmetry, which I will explain to you in a second. And they evolve with energy. As you can see, those Q vectors move to different locations with different energies. So what's going on here, you can see it from the band structure. So the superconducting band structure at the Fermi energy has just 4 points where there are excitations. But as we go away from the Fermi energy, the location of the excitations moves on these trajectories that I'm showing you here. At any given energy, these 8 locations at the ends of these contours of constant energy have the maximum joint density of states for scattering. Because if you calculate the density of states, the band structure is very flat here, so the density of states is very high. So the scattering processes at any given energy are dominated by those 8 locations, this octet of high joint density of states locations. So if you have scattering between these states, you'll produce an interference pattern. The Q of the interference pattern is the difference between the wave vector of the final state and the initial state. So what this is a Fourier transform in which you can measure those Q vectors, because what you were seeing was the interference patterns. Now there's an energy dependence of this phenomenon because of the band structure. So here I show the 8 locations, and here I've drawn all the Q vectors associated with scattering between those locations. But now as a function of energy, those Q vectors should change in a very characteristic pattern as the band structure changes. And that's actually exactly what happens. Changes you see here, the symmetries are consistent, and the changes are consistent with the band structure. If you look, there are 4 points here, there are 4 points here. That's a crystal problem. There are 4 points here, there are 4 points here, etc., etc.
What's about this symmetry of this?
It's the symmetry of the band structure.
It has a distortion.
Well, in BISCO it has a distortion, but that's because the crystal has a distortion. In principle, for D-wave on this whole pocket Fermi surface, it would be tetragonal. You can use this model to find where was the scattering coming from and to measure the gap in the density of states in momentum space by using real space information. This was somewhat of a curiosity when we first figured out how to do it, but now it's becoming an important tool, and I'm going to show you a new application for it on Thursday. It's still pretty amazing. You just take real space information, you get the momentum space electronic structure by using this model. I can tell you that empirically what I showed you is in perfect agreement with studies of the superconducting state by photoemission. The same modulations with the same evolution with energy are observed by other techniques. So this is not some particular pathology of the STM technique. It is an elementary property of the electronic structure in this material. Okay, now let's turn to the disorder. The disorder is focused on these energy ranges. These are the gap maxima. Now the gap maxima are at the zone face within this band structure. So one thing we can do is just take the spectrum at every location and measure the distance between the two peaks and call it twice the gap maximum, and then make an image of the gap maximum, and it looks like this. The gap maximum changes by a factor of up to 3 at this doping, intense disorder, and it does so on a distance scale of 3 nanometers. Now don't be fooled. The material is not heterogeneous. The crystal is fine, and the superconducting electronic structure is homogeneous over very long distance scales. This is a specific property of states at a specific energy and wave vector. See, what's actually happening is the following. Here's a map of one of these energy gaps. And let's say we start, from here. So from here. Here we would have a high gap. It looks like this. And then we move forward and we enter this region. We get a sharp coherence peaks and a low gap, looks like this. And then we exit from that region and we get this high gap. And then we enter the next region here and we get these sharp coherence peaks and low gap, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, at every location in the crystal. So there's intense spatial variations, but if you look down here, you'll see they're concentrated within a band of energies. If you look at these energies, the sample is very, very, very much more electronically homogeneous. You have two different phenomena coexisting. One is spatially disordered. 50 millivolts away, you have a homogeneous electronic structure.
Where is this disorder comes from?
I'll tell you tomorrow. I'll tell you tomorrow. It comes from the dopant atoms. The trigger seems to be the dopant atoms. The mechanism is not known. It's not a trivial mechanism. But there's a good correlation between the dopant atoms and this electronic disorder. Okay, now what happens to this weird disorder as a function of doping? You're going to go from a familiar D-wave superconductor, take away all the carriers until you get to a mod insulator. So if you start over here, now look at the gap scale. It's from 10 millivolts to 70 millivolts. Most of these gaps are near 10 or 15 millivolts. They're still disordered, but the range is small. Now you go down in doping, same spatial disorder. But you see the mean value of the gap is going from 15 millivolts up to 25 millivolts, and here it's going up to 35 millivolts, up to 45, and up to 55, and eventually so high that we can't, black here means we really can't parameterize it properly. So there's a continued, so the disorder exists at all dopings the way it should for the dopant atoms. But the mean value of the gap rises steadily with falling doping. This is already completely contradictory to BCS because the maximum TC is somewhere here. Even though the gap is still rising, the TC is diving down to zero. Statistically, we know what's happening. In these red, anywhere you would see a red region, we would have a spectrum like this. Any place you'd see a yellow or green region, a spectrum like this. Any place a blue region, you have a spectrum like this. Any place a black region, a spectrum like this. What's happening is the probability of these different electronic objects, whatever they are, is changing continuously as the mean value, as the mean doping falls.
What is the reason for this systematic asymmetry?
Oh, that's a good question. I'll answer that on Thursday. Okay. All right. So, you know, our working picture of the situation, and one with which I think most STM people now agree, is that we have homogeneous superconductivity, nodal superconductivity, which just looks like D-wave BCS in every way. But then we have some heterogeneous antinodal, I put localization here, I don't mean in a quantum mechanical sense yet, but there's a progressive damage to these antinodal states, and somehow, they become, well, I'll show you what happens to them in the next piece of the talk. Okay, so the evolution now of this electronic structure with falling doping, how does it work? So there's a famous work by Bob Dines, now more than 20 years ago. In which he showed a simple way to parameterize the density of electronic states for an S-wave superconductor. All he did was take the perfectly infinitely lived quasiparticle density of states, and he added an imaginary piece to each energy to simulate a lifetime or a scattering effect, and then took the real part of this function, and it very nicely simulates the effects that you would really see if you calculate in detail, let's say by Abrakosov-Gorkov for magnetic impurities in S-wave. So for an experimentalist, this is a nice tool. You need one more parameter to follow what's happening to the electronic structure as you're altering the scattering rate very dramatically. Now, we've been posing the following question to ourselves. Can we carry out the Dynes scheme, but for the D-wave high TC superconductors? So here are the various spectra we're dealing with. So near optimal doping looks like this. Go down in doping, farther down, farther down, farther down. These are averages of all spectra with the same gap value so as to get away some of the disorder. But actually, statistically, they're all highly distinct from each other. These are the one sigma of the average. So for example, this spectrum is clearly highly distinct from that spectrum. We're not mixing different types together here. And then what's happening as a function of doping, on the average, is we're just evolving from these red guys through these yellow-green guys to these blue guys and finally to these guys at the bottom. If there was no disorder, the hypothesis is that this is what would be happening to the electronic structure. Okay, now can you parameterize that? So here's the scheme we chose. This is a Dienstahl equation. We take a constant times the real part, and here's a E plus I gamma term, and here it is under the line. Now there's a background slope which we need to take out. So this is the energy background which will be removed by the fit. If you put a constant gamma, as in the Dienstahl equation, this is just a constant scattering rate. If you put a constant scattering rate here, the fit will fail. They're all bad. It just doesn't work. But if you put a scattering rate here, which is linear in energy, it's a constant but linear in energy, so that the scattering rate on the Fermi surface is itself very low near the node but very high near the antinode, then this equation evolving with different scattering rates looks like this. Perfectly coherent, more scattering, more scattering, more scattering. It has the property that it retains the nodes because you make the scattering rate linear in energy. So does it work? Actually, it works perfectly. It works beautifully. You can fit all the spectra and all dopings, millions and millions of spectra. It works really nicely. So now, I don't mean to imply that it is as simple as the Dienstahl situation. This is not a piece of lead with some magnetic impurities in it. But it does appear to be true that you can parameterize the evolution of the electronic structure by using a scattering rate linear in energy that changes rapidly with doping. Now let me show you some reason why you should believe that. So what this means is that we can fit each one of these spectra and extract the gap maximum and the scattering rate separately. So here's those old peak-to-peak maps of the energy gap. And here we put white to emphasize that these were regions where we just couldn't fit. We didn't have any peaks. We couldn't fit any energy gap. But now with this Dienstahl fit, we can fit at all dopings, and here we can measure the energy gap. Now these are simultaneous data sets, and you see where the fits are working simultaneously. They're in excellent agreement. Actually, the cross-correlation exceeds 90%. So the fitting scheme is in complete agreement with the previous data sets, except it improves on it because now we can find the gap value in regions which were impossible before. And the other thing we can do is find the scattering rate, and it also, it's disordered, but relatively constant, and then below a certain doping, somewhere near 16 or 15%, the scattering rate takes off very rapidly.
Sorry, what is delta peak sub-fitting?
This one is the one where you take your raw spectrum with no fitting, you just measure the distance between there and there and call it 2 delta pp, the crudest
delta
possible.
One is
delta 1 is the fit of each spectrum by this function. This function has a D wave gap in it. The maximum magnitude of the D wave gap is delta 1. Okay, now the first thing we discovered with this scheme, when we could fit all the values of delta, is that if we take, these are all different dopings. I won't even tell you which doping is which, but I assure you they range from 23% to 8%. So electronically, the structure is supposed to be very, very different. But now we know all the gap values. So for each one of those maps of the gap value, we can divide by the mean gap value of that same sample. And here are the histograms as a function of doping. Okay, and they're identical, statistically identical to each other. The electronic disorder is the same at all dopings. Now the mean value of the gap is rising rapidly. But otherwise, the fluctuations about that mean value are the same at all dopings. This was a surprise to me. It seems to indicate that nothing different is happening at different dopings. So the scale of the gap with falling doping looks like this. It's rising steadily, and it gets up above 80 millivolts, near 10%, according to this fit. And here's what happens to the maximum scattering rate. It's relatively small, just a few millivolts, until you come near 15 or 16%, and then it turns up very rapidly, following a trajectory which is about a quarter of the gap maximum. So what that means is that near optimal doping, you have some anisotropic scattering, but it's so weak compared to the gap maximum that it doesn't do any terrible disaster. But when you go up, when you go down to underdoping, what's happening is that this anisotropic scattering is rising extremely rapidly, at least if you believe this fit to the spectra. So once again, our perception is that we have homogeneous nodal superconductivity. It's not very heavily scattered, and it survives at all dopings. And at the same time, we have heterogeneous antinodal states. So here we're outside the gap. Now we're going to come to the gap maximum right about here. These states are very heavily scattered. That's obvious from the real space picture and from the fitting of the scattering rate. And then as we go down along the Fermi surface, the scattering rate diminishes. When it falls low enough, we see the quasiparticle interference.
May I ask you, I don't understand completely, where scattering is bigger, in plane or perpendicular?
In plane. This is all parameterized as if it's in plane scattering.
Okay.
And so I think my time is up, and with that, let me take some questions.
Have you seen the peak in the center?
Of the vortex core?
No, in the center of the gap.
No.
That is what people normally...
I know, that's what everybody expects, but that's the one thing you don't see in the cube rates.
And moreover, it was observed in another experiment.
Correct. But
why not in yours? That's very interesting.
Well, so there's a couple of possibilities. There is a C-axis tunneling matrix element in these studies, which has a symmetry, which has a node. So there's a possibility that we just don't pick up the nodal states.
You need to make some geometrical change.
Yeah, so that's one possibility. But also, you know, fitting all this data away from the nodes, it's also clear that the region near the nodes is interacting very weakly with its environment. It's scattering very weakly. It's well protected from the crystalline and dopant disorder. That's why the high TC survives. The cube rates are horribly disordered material, but the nodal quasiparticles really don't care. Yeah?
If I may venture an opinion on these states from the vortex core, this matrix element, if it was the cause, it would also modify your low energy dispersion in the absence of a vortex.
Yeah.
I think there's really something anomalous going on in the core of a vortex. Instead of that state being metallic, it's the Mott insulator that would be the underlying state if you destroy superconducting water.
You think that that is only what changes only the superconducting order parameter, but the metallic state in the ground, it doesn't change very much.
Well, the background state is not a metal. You can apply 60 or 70 Tesla and kill the superconductivity. You'll be in an insulating state, not a metallic state. 60, 70 Tesla, that's what Bobinger does, yeah.
That's one of the central mysteries here. You know, how do you get superconductor on top of something that does not seem to be an ordinary metal in its normal state? Mm-hmm.
Such a big field, probably you should initially work not with plane wave, but something with Landau states or like that.
Yeah, correct. Yeah.
Is the picture for this scattering at gamma will actually increase with energy, or will actually scale with the gap?
Well, so I have a, I can discuss a picture which I don't have, which I think it's highly unlikely, for example, that, you know, impurity scattering is somehow evolving as you diminish the doping so as to produce this effect. And from that argument, I deduce that it has to be scattering either off the antiferromagnetic fluctuations or fluctuations of some other order parameter. So I don't know, and I don't think anybody knows what that other state is. But this rapidly growing scattering rate, there's really no reason for it to be there. For example, suppose TC is falling due to Koster-Less Dallas, just because the carrier density is falling. There's absolutely no reason for this enormous scattering rate to come on. So this implies that there's a very strong antinodal interaction with something else. But what that something else is, we don't know. So the oxychloride work is being done by our collaborator Tetsuo Haneguri and Hide Tagaki. And so now they have done the vortex core experiment, and they have done the quasiparticle interference experiment. And they're in excellent agreement with the BSCO results. And together we have done these asymmetry mapping experiments, and there the two materials are indistinguishable. So within our data sets, we have two completely different cuprates that appear to have the same physical properties. So we assume that they are real properties of the CO2 plane, intrinsic properties.
So you said it's gamma to whatever
spectrum. Oh, gamma. I don't know if the gamma fit has been done yet. Right. But, you know, the spectra are evolving in the same way.
Presumably.
Yeah. So presumably it'll look similar.
So, the same spectrum, eh?